Chapter 2. Just Cause. First, they ate the animals in the zoo. Then, they ate their cats and dogs. Some even resorted to eating wallpaper paste and boiled leather. Then, the unthinkable. A child died. He was just 3 years old, wrote Daniel Granin, one of the survivors. His mother laid the body inside the double-glazed window and sliced off a piece of him every day to feed her second child. These were some of the extremes the people of Leningrad were driven to during the Nazis' nearly 900-day siege of the city from September 1941 to January 1944. Over 1 million citizens, including 400,000 children, died, many of them due to starvation. And all of the while, unbeknownst to the masses, a stash of hundreds of thousands of seeds and tons of potatoes, rice, nuts, and cereal lay hidden in the heart of the city. About 25 years before the siege began, a young botanist named Nikolai Vavilov started building his seed collection. Growing up in a time when Russia was ravaged by major famines that killed millions of people, he committed his life and his work to ending hunger and preventing future ecological disasters. What started as idealism eventually became a highly focused cause for Vavilov. He traveled the world to collect various types of food crops and learn more about what made some more resilient than others. Before long, he had collected seeds from over 6,000 types of crops. He also started to study genetics and experimented with developing new strains of crops that could better resist pests or disease, grow more quickly, withstand harsh conditions, or offer higher yields of food. As his work advanced, Vavilov's vision for a seed bank crystallized. Just as we keep a backup of important data should our computer crash, Vavilov wanted to have a backup of the seeds for all the world's food should any species become extinct or ungrowable due to natural or man-made disasters. Having built up quite a reputation and an even larger seed collection, in 1920, Vavilov left his life as an academic to become the head of the Department of Applied Botany in Leningrad. With the help of government funding, Vavilov was able to bring together a whole team of scientists to join him in his work and help advance his cause. Upon his arrival at the institution, Vavilov wrote, "I would like the department to be a necessary institution, as useful to everybody as possible. I'd like to gather the varietal diversity from all over the world, organize them all, and turn the department into the treasury of all crops and other floras." And like any good visionary with an infinite mindset, he concluded, "The outcome is uncertain, but still I want to try." Within 2 years, however, things had changed. This was Joseph Stalin's Soviet Union, and no one was safe. Not even the highly respected Vavilov. Over the course of his rule, which lasted from 1922 until his death in 1953, Stalin is said to have been responsible for the deaths of over 20 million of his own people. And sadly, the scientist who had devoted his life to helping his country's people found himself one of Stalin's political targets. Arrested in 1940 on trumped-up charges of espionage, Vavilov was subjected to over 400 sessions of brutal interrogation, some lasting 13 hours, all with the intent to break his spirit and coerce a confession that he was an anti-Stalin sympathizer. But Vavilov was not a man who could be easily broken, not even under such extreme conditions. Despite his captor's best efforts, Vavilov never broke. He never confessed to the false charges against him. Sadly, in 1943, at only 55 years old, the visionary botanist and plant geneticist who had devoted his life to ending hunger died in prison of malnutrition. At the time of Vavilov's death, the siege of Leningrad was raging. There, in the middle of a war zone, hidden in a rather nondescript building in St. Isaac Square, were the records of all the work Vavilov's team had done, and of course, their priceless seed collection, which now consisted of hundreds of thousands of varieties of crops. Beyond the obvious risks from shelling, the collection was also threatened by an explosion of rats in the city. The starving people had eaten all the cats, which would ordinarily control the rat population. And as if that weren't enough, Vavilov's collection had also caught the attention of the Nazis. Obsessed with eugenics and his own health, Hitler knew the value of the seed bank and wanted it for himself and for Germany. The problem was, although Hitler knew of its existence, he did not know its location. So he tasked a group within his army to find it. Despite the threats, and despite being subjected to the same grueling conditions as all the other residents of Leningrad, Vavilov's team of scientists continued their work throughout the siege. They ventured out in the middle of winter, for instance, to re-sow secret plots of potatoes in a field near the front lines. Though they were able to smuggle some of their work out of the city, the rest they kept hidden and under guard. The scientists were so devoted to Vavilov's vision that they were prepared to protect the seed bank at any cost, even if the cost was their lives. In the end, surrounded by hundreds of thousands of seeds, tons of potatoes, rice, nuts, cereals, and other crops that they refused to eat, 9 of the scientists died of starvation. When talking about his cause, Vavilov was once quoted as saying, "We shall go into the pyre, we shall burn, but we shall not retreat from our convictions." And those who joined him in common cause were more than inspired by Vavilov's words. They lived them. One of the survivors, Vadim Leknovich, who helped plant the seed potatoes and stood guard over them while shots flew through the air, was later asked about not eating the bounty. "It was hard to walk. It was unbearably hard to get up every morning, to move your hands and feet," he said. "But it was not in the least difficult to refrain from eating up the collection, for it was impossible to think of eating it up. For what was involved was the cause of your life, the cause of your comrades' lives." The scientists who carried on Vavilov's work during the siege felt like they were a part of something bigger than themselves. This just cause, a mission for all humanity, as Vavilov called it, gave their work and their lives purpose and meaning beyond any one individual or the very real struggles they faced in the moment of the siege. To have fed themselves or even to have fed the masses of starving residents in the city would have been a finite solution to a finite problem. Though they may have helped prolong the lives of some who would still likely have died, or even save the lives of others, they were looking beyond the immediate horizon. They weren't imagining the relatively few lives they could save in Leningrad. They imagined a future state in which their work might save entire civilizations. Their work was not devoted to getting to the end of the siege. They were playing to keep the human race going for as long as possible. What a just cause is. Howard's Little League team was one of, if not the worst in the league. At the end of each lost game, his coach would say to the players, "It doesn't matter who wins or loses. What matters is how we played the game." At which point, the precocious young Howard would raise his hand and ask the coach, "Then why do we keep score?" When we play in a finite game, we play the game to win. Even if we hope to simply play well and enjoy the game, we do not play to lose. The motivation to play in an infinite game is completely different. The goal is not to win, but to keep playing. It is to advance something bigger than ourselves or our organizations. And any leader who wishes to lead in the infinite game must have a crystal clear just cause. A just cause is a specific vision of a future state that does not yet exist, a future state so appealing that people are willing to make sacrifices in order to help advance toward that vision. Like Vavilov's scientists, the sacrifice people are willing to make may be their lives, but it needn't be. It can be the choice to turn down a better-paying job in order to keep working for an organization that is working to advance a just cause in which we believe. It may mean working late hours or taking frequent business trips. Though we may not like the sacrifices we make, it is because of the just cause that they feel worth it. Winning provides a temporary thrill of victory, an intense but fleeting boost to our self-confidence. None of us is able to hold on to that incredible feeling of accomplishment for that target we hit, promotion we earned, or tournament we won a year ago. Those feelings have passed. To get that feeling again, we need to try to win again. However, when there is a just cause, a reason to come to work that is bigger than any particular win, our days take on more meaning and feel more fulfilling. Feelings that carry on week after week, month after month, year after year. In an organization that is only driven by the finite, we may like our jobs some days, but we will likely never love our jobs. If we work for an organization with a just cause, we may like our jobs some days, but we will always love our jobs. As with our kids, we may like them some days and not others, but we love them every day. A just cause is not the same as our why. A why comes from the past. It is an origin story. It is a statement of who we are, the sum total of our beliefs and values. A just cause is about the future. It defines where we are going. It describes the world we hope to live in and will commit to help build. Everyone has their own why, and everyone can know what their why is if they choose to uncover it. But we do not have to have our own just cause. We can choose to join someone else's. Indeed, we can start a movement, or we can choose to join one and make it our own. Unlike a why, of which there can be only one, we can work to advance more than one just cause. Our why is fixed, and it cannot be changed. In contrast, because a just cause is about something as of yet unbuilt, we do not know exactly the form it will take. We can work tirelessly to build it however we want and make constant improvements along the way. Think of the why like the foundation of a house. It is the starting point. It gives whatever we build upon its strength and permanence. Our just cause is the ideal vision of the house we hope to build. We can work a lifetime to build it, and still we will not be finished. However, the results of our work help give the house form. As it moves from our imagination to reality, it inspires more people to join the cause and continue the work forever. For example, my why is to inspire people to do what inspires them, so that together we can each change our world for the better. It is uniquely mine. My just cause is to build a world in which the vast majority of people wake up inspired, feel safe at work, and return home fulfilled at the end of the day. And I'm looking for as many people as possible who will join me in this cause. It is the just cause that we are working to advance that gives our work and our lives meaning. A just cause inspires us to stay focused beyond the finite rewards and individual wins. The just cause provides the context for all the finite games we must play along the way. A just cause is what inspires us to want to keep playing. Whether in science, nation building, or business, leaders who want us to join them in their infinite pursuit must offer us, in clear terms, an affirmative and tangible vision of the ideal future state they imagine. When the founding fathers of the United States declared independence from Great Britain, for example, they knew that such a radical act would require a statement of just cause. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, they wrote in the Declaration of Independence, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The vision they set forth was not simply one of a nation defined by borders, but of an ideal future state defined by principles of liberty and equality for all. And on July 4, 1776, the 56 men who signed on to that vision agreed to, as they put it, mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. This was how much it mattered to them. They were willing to give up their own finite lives and interests to carry forward the infinite idea and ideals of a new nation. Their sacrifice, in turn, inspired subsequent generations to embrace the same cause and devote their own blood, sweat, and tears to continue to advance it. We know a cause is just when we commit to it with the confidence that others will carry on our legacy. This was certainly the case for America's founders, and it was the case for Nikolai Vavilov. Vavilov's vision of a world in which entire populations, and indeed all of humanity, will always have a source of food, ensuring that we can survive as long as possible, carries on to this day. There are nearly 2,000 seed banks spread across more than 100 countries around the world that are continuing the work that Vavilov started a lifetime ago. The Svalbard Global Seed Vault in Norway is one of the largest. Located in a naturally temperature-controlled environment in the Arctic, the Svalbard Vault stores over 1 billion seeds from nearly 6,000 species of flora. It is there to ensure that in the worst-case scenario, we would have a food source to keep our species alive. Marie Haga, the executive director of the Crop Trust, the organization formed in partnership with the United Nations to help support the work of global seed banks, points to Vavilov as the ostensible founder of the cause. A century after Vavilov's first journeys, she said, a new generation of dedicated crop diversity supporters continue to travel the world to conserve not only germplasm, but also Vavilov's legacy. Many of the organizations we work for now already have some sort of purpose, vision, or mission statement, or all of them, written on the walls that our leaders hope will inspire us. However, the vast majority of them would not qualify as a just cause. At best, they are uninspiring and innocuous. At worst, they point us in a direction to keep playing in the finite realm. Even some of the best-intentioned attempts are written in a way that is finite, generic, self-centered, or too vague to be of any use in the infinite game. Common attempts include statements like, "We do the stuff you don't want to do so that you can focus on the things you love to do." It may be a true statement, it's just a true statement for too many things, especially in the business-to-business space. Plus, it's not much of a rallying cry. Another common generic vision sounds like, "To offer the highest quality products, at the best possible value, etc., etc." Statements like this are of little use for those who wish to lead us in the infinite game. Such statements are not inclusive. They are egocentric about the company. They look inward and are not about the future state to which the products or services are contributing. Vizio, the California-based maker of televisions and speakers, says on their website, for example, that they exist to deliver high performance, smarter products with the latest innovations at a significant savings that we can pass along to our consumers. I take them at their word that they do all those things. But do those words really inspire people to want to offer their blood, sweat, or tears? When you hear those words, are you inspired to rush to apply for a job there? Few, if any of us, get goosebumps or feel a visceral calling to be a part of something like that. Such statements offer us neither a cause to which we would commit ourselves nor a sense of what it's all for, both of which are essential in the infinite game. Again, a just cause is a specific vision of a future state that does not yet exist. And in order for a just cause to provide direction for our work, to inspire us to sacrifice, and to endure not just in the present, but for lifetimes beyond our own, it must meet 5 standards. Those who are unsure whether their purpose, mission, or vision statement is a just cause, or those interested in leading with a just cause, can use these standards as a simple test. A just cause must be for something, affirmative and optimistic, inclusive, open to all those who would like to contribute, service-oriented, for the primary benefit of others, resilient, able to endure political, technological, and cultural change, and idealistic, big, bold, and ultimately unachievable. For something, affirmative and optimistic. A just cause is something we stand for and believe in, not something we oppose. Leaders can rally people against something quite easily. They can whip them into a frenzy, even, for our emotions can run hot when we are angry or afraid. Being for something, in contrast, is about feeling inspired. Being for ignites the human spirit and fills us with hope and optimism. Being against is about vilifying, demonizing, or rejecting. Being for is about inviting all to join in common cause. Being against focuses our attention on the things we can see in order to elicit reactions. Being for focuses our attention on the unbuilt future in order to spark our imaginations. Imagine if instead of fighting against poverty, for example, we fought for the right of every human to provide for their own family. The first creates a common enemy, something we are against. It sets up the cause as if it's winnable, i.e., a finite game. It leads us to believe that we can defeat poverty once and for all. The second gives us a cause to advance. The impact of the two perspectives is more than semantics. It affects how we view the problem or vision, and affects our ideas on how we can contribute. Where the first offers a problem to solve, the second offers a vision of possibility, dignity, and empowerment. We're not inspired to reduce poverty. We are inspired to grow the number of people who are able to provide for themselves and their families. Being for or being against is a subtle but profound difference that the writers of the Declaration of Independence intuitively understood. Those who led America toward independence stood against Great Britain in the short term. Indeed, the American colonists were deeply offended by how they were treated by England. Over 60% of the Declaration of Independence is spent laying out specific grievances against the king. However, the cause they were fighting for was the true source of lasting inspiration, and in the Declaration of Independence, it came before anything else. It is the first idea we read in the document. It sets the context for the rest of the Declaration and the direction for moving forward. It is the ideal to which we personally relate and that we have easily committed to memory. Few Americans, except for scholars and the most zealous of history buffs, can even rattle off one of the complaints listed later in the document. Things like, he has endeavored to prevent the population of these states, for that purpose obstructing the laws for naturalization of foreigners, refusing to pass others to encourage their migrations hither, and raising the conditions of new appropriations of lands. In contrast, most Americans can recite with ease, all men are created equal, and can usually rattle off the three tenets of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. These words are indelibly marked on the cultural psyche. Invoked by patriots and politicians alike, they remind Americans of who we strive to be and the ideals upon which our nation was founded. They tell us what we stand for. Inclusive, open to all those who would like to contribute. Human beings want to feel a part of something. We crave the feeling of belonging. We enjoy the feeling of being a part of a group, like when we attend church, attend a parade or rally, or wear the jersey of our favorite team when we attend a sports event. A just cause serves as an invitation to join others in advancing a cause bigger than ourselves. When the words of the just cause help us imagine a positive, specific, alternative vision of the future, it stirs something inside us that makes us want to raise our hand to join up and join in. A well-crafted statement of cause inspires us to offer our ideas, our time, our experience, our hands, anything that may help advance the new vision of the future it articulates. This is how movements come to be. It starts with a few people. Their idealized vision of the future attracts believers. Those early adopters don't show up to get anything, they show up to give. They want to help. They want to play a role in advancing toward a new vision of the future. The cause that attracted them becomes their own. Organizations that simply promise to, quote, change the world or make an impact, tell us very little about what specifically they want to accomplish. The sentiments are good, but they are too generic to serve as a meaningful filter for us. Again, a just cause is a specific vision of a future state that does not yet exist. A future state so appealing that people are willing to make sacrifices in order to help advance toward that vision. We call it vision because it must be something that we can see. For a just cause to serve as an effective invitation, the words must paint a specific and tangible picture of the kind of impact we will make or what exactly a better world would look like. Only when we can imagine in our mind's eye the exact version of the world an organization or leader hopes to advance toward will we know to which organization or to which leader we want to commit our energies and ourselves. A clear cause is what ignites our passions. We only hire passionate people, is the oft-recited standard of many a person responsible for hiring. How do they know, however, whether the candidate is passionate for interviewing, but not so passionate for the cause? The reality is, everyone is passionate about something, But we aren't all passionate about the same thing. Infinite-minded leaders actively seek out employees, customers, and investors who share a passion for the just cause. For employees, this is what we mean when we say hire for culture, and you can always teach the skills later. For customers and investors, this is the root of love and loyalty for the organization itself. The quick-serve salad company Sweetgreen stands for something bigger than selling salads, for example, and they invite would-be contributors to join their cause. Their stated mission is to inspire healthier communities by connecting people to real food. Real food, as Sweetgreen defines it, means ingredients from local sources that support local farms, which is why their stores have different menus depending on which part of the country they're in. Though many of us may buy their salads just because we like their salads, those who are devoted to locally sourced food and want to support local farms will be drawn to work for and become the most loyal supporters of Sweetgreen. They will make sacrifices, like going out of their way or paying a premium to buy from Sweetgreen. Supporting the company in some shape or form is one of the things they do to feel that they are advancing their own values and beliefs, their own vision of a better world. They feel included in the cause. Service-oriented, for the primary benefit of others. A just cause must involve at least two parties, the contributors and the beneficiaries, the givers and the receivers. Contributors give something, such as their ideas, hard work, or money, to help advance the just cause, and the receivers of those contributions benefit. For a just cause to pass the service orientation test, the primary benefit of the organization's contributions must always go to people other than the contributors themselves. If my boss offers me career advice, for example, that advice must be for the primary benefit of my career and not theirs. If I am an investor, I must intend that the primary benefit of my contribution goes to helping the company advance its just cause. If I am a leader, I must intend that the primary benefit of my time, effort, and decisions goes to those I lead. And if I'm a frontline employee, I must intend that the primary benefit of my efforts goes to the people buying our product or service. If there is only one party, if we are the sole beneficiaries of our work, that's not a just cause. That's a vanity project. When Sweetgreen talks about the beneficiaries of its contributions, they talk about the communities and people. They don't talk about what their contributions will do for Sweetgreen. And the drafters of the Declaration of Independence were clear that we the people, not we the leaders, would be the primary beneficiaries of their efforts and of the revolution. If those who led the fight had made themselves the primary beneficiaries, then America would probably have ended up with a dictatorship or an oligarchy. With that new perspective, we instantly see what follows when a company says the primary beneficiaries of their work are shareholders, not customers. The operative word in all of this is primary. Service orientation does not mean charity. In charity, the vast majority, if not all, the benefit of our contributions must go to the receiver, and any benefit the contributor gets is the good feeling that they contributed. In business, of course we can consider how our work will benefit us or advance our own lot. Of course we can expect and even demand to be fairly compensated and recognized for our efforts and results. We can want our investors to benefit too, just not at the expense of the company, the people who work there, or the customers who buy from us. No beneficiary, no customer should be forced to buy a substandard product, and no employee should lose their job as a result of cost-cutting performed to benefit a shareholder who is, after all, just one of a group of contributors. Again, only when the primary beneficiary of the cause is someone other than the organization itself can the cause be just. This is what servant leadership means. It means the primary benefit of the contributions flows downstream. In an organization where service orientation is lacking, or treated as a sideshow rather than the main event, the flow of benefits tends to go upstream instead. Investors invest with the primary intention of seeing a return before anyone else. Leaders make decisions that benefit themselves before those in their charge. Salespeople ensure they do whatever they need to do to make the sale to earn their bonus, regardless of what the customer needs. This is the common flow of benefit in so many of our organizations today. Too many of our corporate cultures are filled with people working to protect their own interests and the interests of those above them before those of the people they're supposed to be serving. The requirement that a just cause be service-oriented is consistent with how infinite games are supposed to be played. The infinite player wants to keep the game going for others. A leader who wishes to build an organization equipped for the infinite game must never make decisions solely to boost their own compensation. Their efforts should go toward equipping the organization for the game in which it is operating. Even an investor must not be the primary beneficiary of their investment. Rather, it is the organization in which they believe and whose just cause they want to see advance that must benefit from their financial contribution. An infinite-minded investor wants to contribute to advance something bigger than themselves, which, if it is successful, will be highly profitable. A finite-minded investor is more like a gambler who bets solely so they may reap the reward. Let us not confuse the two behaviors. The reason a service orientation is so important in the infinite game is because it builds a loyal base of employees and customers and investors who will stick with the organization through thick and thin. It is this strong base of loyalty that gives any organization a kind of strength and longevity that money alone cannot provide. The most loyal employees feel their leaders genuinely care about them, because their leaders genuinely do care about them. In return, they offer their best ideas, act freely and responsibly, and work to solve problems for the benefit of the company. The most loyal customers feel the company genuinely cares about their wants, needs, and desires, because the company really does. And in return, this is why loyal customers go out of their way or pay a premium to buy from that company over another and encourage their friends to do the same. And the best-led companies feel like their investors genuinely care about helping the company become as strong as possible in order to advance the cause, because the investors really do care, and the results benefit all the stakeholders. Resilient, able to endure political, technological, and cultural change. Leaders who wish to lead with an infinite mindset would do well to keep the example of the Declaration of Independence in mind. The founders' stated commitment to equality and unalienable human rights are evergreen. Over the course of more than 240 years, even as the nation's leaders, landscape, people, and culture have changed, the just cause has remained as relevant and inspiring as ever. It is a just cause for an infinite time frame. In the infinite game of business, a just cause must be greater than the products we make and the services we offer. Our products and services are some of the things we use to advance our just cause. They are not themselves the cause. If we articulate our cause in terms of our products, then our organization's entire existence is conditional on the relevance of those products. Any new technology could render our products, our cause, and indeed our entire company, obsolete overnight. The American Railroads, for example, were some of the largest companies in the country, until advancements in automotive technology and a network of highways offered people a quicker and sometimes cheaper alternative to the train. Had the railroads defined their need to exist in terms related to moving people and things, instead of advancing the railroad, they might be the owners of major car companies or airlines today. Publishers saw themselves in the book business instead of the spreading ideas business, and thus missed the opportunity to capitalize on new technology to advance their cause. They could have invented Amazon or the digital e-reader. Had the music industry defined themselves as the sharers of music rather than the sellers of records, tapes, and CDs, they would have had an easier time in a world of digital streaming. By defining themselves by a cause greater than the products they sold, they could have invented services like iTunes or Spotify, but they didn't, and now they're paying the price for it. Markets will rise and fall. People will come and go. Technologies will evolve. Products and services will adapt to consumer tastes and market demands. We need something with permanence for us to rally around, something that can withstand change and crisis. To keep us in the infinite game, our cause must be durable, resilient, and timeless. Idealistic, big, bold, and ultimately unachievable. When the signers of the Declaration of Independence affirm that all men are created equal and endowed with certain unalienable rights, they were referring primarily to white Anglo-Saxon Protestant men. Almost immediately, however, there were efforts to advance a more expansive and inclusive understanding of the ideal. During the Revolutionary War, for example, George Washington forbade anti-Catholic organizing in his armies and regularly attended Catholic services to model the behavior he expected of his men. Nearly 100 years later, the Civil War brought about an end to slavery, and soon after that, the 14th Amendment granted citizenship and equal rights to African Americans and former slaves. The women's suffrage movement took another step toward America's just cause when it gained the vote for women in 1920. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which protected African Americans and others from discrimination, were two more steps. The nation took yet another step in 2015 with the Supreme Court decision in Obergefell v. Hodges, which extended the protections guaranteed by the 14th Amendment to gay marriage. If the founders of the United States had only set out a goal to win independence, once it was achieved, they would have grabbed a pint of ale and sat around playing rounds of ninepins and ringtaw while regaling each other with how great it was that they won the war. But that's not what happened. Instead, they got to work writing a constitution, which was only fully ratified 7 years after the official end of the Revolutionary War, to further codify a set of enduring principles to protect and advance their big, bold, idealistic vision of the future. A vision that Americans have been striving to protect and advance ever since quill and ink touched paper, and will continue to protect and advance as long as we have the will and resources to do so. America's just cause has yet to be fully realized, and for all practical purposes, it never will be. But we will die trying, and that's the point. Indeed, the abolition of slavery, women's suffrage, the Civil Rights Act, and gay rights are some of the big steps the nation has taken to realize its cause. And though each of those movements, infinite in their own right, are still far from complete, they still represent clear steps along the nation's march toward the ideals enshrined in the Declaration of Independence. It is important to celebrate our victories, but we cannot linger on them, for the infinite game is still going, and there is still much work to be done. Those victories must serve as milestones of our progress toward an idealized future. They give us a glimpse of what our idealized future can look like and serve as an inspiration to keep moving forward. This is what the idealized journey of a just cause feels like. No matter how much we have achieved, we always feel we have further to go. Think of a just cause like an iceberg. All we ever see is the tip of that iceberg, the things we have already accomplished. In an organization, it is often the founders and early contributors who have the clearest vision of the unknown future, of what, to everyone else, remains unseen. The clearer the words of the just cause, the more likely they will attract and invite the innovators and early adopters, those willing to take the first risks to advance something that exists almost entirely in their imaginations. With each success, a little more of the iceberg is revealed to others. The vision becomes more visible to others. And when others can see a vision becoming something real, skeptics become believers, and even more people feel inspired by the possibility and willingly commit their time and energy, ideas and talents to help advance the cause further. But no matter how much of the iceberg we can see, our leaders have the responsibility to remind us that the vast majority still lies unexplored. For no matter how much success we may enjoy, the just cause for which we are working lies ahead and not behind. When you have a cause, write it down. The founding fathers of the United States were larger-than-life figures. They lived and breathed their just cause. This is often the case with inspirational leaders in business as well. But what happens when those charismatic keepers of the cause move on, retire, or die? I'm often surprised how many visionary leaders don't think they need to find the words for or write down their cause. They assume that because their vision is clear to them, it's clear to everyone else in the organization, which of course it's not. Without finding the words for the just cause and writing them down, it dramatically increases the risk that in time, the cause will be diluted or disappear altogether. And without the just cause, an organization starts to function like a ship without a compass. It veers off course. Focus moves from beyond the horizon to the dials in front of them. Without a just cause to guide them, finite-mindedness starts to creep in. The leaders will celebrate how fast they are going, how many miles they have traveled, but fail to recognize that their journey lacks any direction or purpose. A just cause that is preserved on paper can be handed down from generation to generation. A founder's instinct cannot. Like the Declaration of Independence, a written statement of cause dramatically increases the chances that the cause will survive to guide and inspire future generations beyond the founders and those who knew the founders. It's the difference between a verbal contract and a written contract. Both are legal and enforceable, but when a contract is written, it prevents any confusion or disagreement about the terms of the deal, especially for people who weren't there when the deal was made. A written cause works like a compass, and with a compass in hand, each succession of leaders, their gaze looking beyond the horizon, can more easily navigate the technologies, politics, and cultural norms of the day without the founder present. Chapter 3. Cause, no cause. Let's play a quick round of cause, no cause. It's a good thing that more and more companies seem to be embracing the importance of having a purpose at the heart of their business. The problem is, too many of them say things that only sound like a just cause. Indeed, they may even use language and meet some of the standards of a just cause. Until they can check all five boxes, however, what they offer simply isn't a just cause. There are a few main reasons we fail to put forward a true just cause. Sometimes the visionary cause-driven leader adopts a false cause by accident because they're struggling to find the words to embody what they imagine for the future. Refer to the previous chapter for help. In other cases, the leader wants people to believe that they are cause-driven when, in fact, they have no vision at all. Common imposter causes include things like moonshots, a drive to be the best, or mistaking growth for purpose. It is also common to find organizations confusing their corporate social responsibility program for a just cause. Any of these may or may not work in the finite game, but they absolutely cannot lead an organization to survive and thrive in the infinite game. The reason to identify these pitfalls is first as a warning that to embrace any of these will not prepare an organization for life in the infinite game, but rather keep it playing squarely with a finite mindset. The other reason to point them out is simply so that we can know if indeed we have a just cause or not and go back to the drawing board if we need to. We might even avoid coming up with a false cause in the first place. An organization that has a false cause is not a bad company. It just means they have a little more work to do. The ability to recognize false causes can also save us pain as investors, employees, and consumers. If we suspect that one organization does not have a just cause, we can move on to another one that does. A true just cause is deeply personal to those who hear it, and it must be deeply personal to those who espouse it. The more personal it is for people, the more likely our passions will be stoked to help advance it. If the words of a just cause are simply used to boost a brand image, attract passionate employees, or help drive some near-term goal like a purchase, a vote, or support for the company, the impact will be short-lived. As soon as we start working at an organization or interacting with its people, we will quickly find out whether they are offering us a just cause they truly believe in or just hollow words. Moonshots are not a just cause. He offered us something to believe in, something that was bigger than us, something we were willing to sacrifice to see happen. "We choose to go to the moon," said President John F. Kennedy with determination. "We choose to go to the moon in this decade, not because it is easy, but because it is hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. Because that challenge is one that we are willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one which we intend to win." And just over 8 years after Kennedy first challenged the nation, Neil Armstrong took one small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind. The so-called moonshot is often invoked by leaders who are trying to inspire their people to reach for something that seems impossible. And because moonshots pass most of the tests of a just cause, it usually works. In the case of Kennedy's actual moonshot, it is affirmative and specific. It is inclusive, service-oriented, and definitely worthy of sacrifice. However, it is not infinite. No matter how hard the challenge, no matter how impossible it seemed, the moonshot was an achievable, finite goal. More than an ideal future state, it is what Jim Collins, author of Good to Great and Built to Last, calls a BHAG, a big, hairy, audacious goal. It's easy to mistake a BHAG for a just cause, because they can indeed be incredibly inspiring and often take many years to achieve. But after the moonshot has been achieved, the game continues. Simply choosing another big, audacious goal is not infinite play. It's just another finite pursuit. During employee town hall meetings at GE, some of the employees would express concern that the company was too focused on the short term. Jack Welch, then CEO, was fond of replying, "Long term is just a series of short terms." When employees express such a concern to a CEO, more likely than not, what they are really asking is, what's it all for? What is all our hard work contributing to beyond the metrics and material rewards? Welch's answer revealed that, to him, there was no higher cause at play. The goal was simply to perform, perform again, and perform again. To Welch, each finite accomplishment was enough. Except business is an infinite game, which means the series of short terms never ends. Indeed, leaping from goal to goal can be fun for a while, but if that's all there is, over time the thrill of each achievement becomes less, well, thrilling. I often meet senior executives who seem to suffer from a kind of finite exhaustion. Because they did well and were paid well for hitting each goal set for them, they kept repeating that pattern. At some point in their careers, they traded any fantasy of feeling like their work would contribute to something bigger than themselves for a rat race, or a hamster wheel, or some other unfulfilling running rodent metaphor. Racking up finite wins does not lead to something more infinite. The question that a just cause must answer is, what is the infinite and lasting vision that a moonshot will help advance? A just cause is the context for all our other goals, big and small, and all our finite achievements must help to advance the just cause. Indeed, if we become overly concerned with a finite goal, no matter how inspiring, we leave ourselves open to making decisions that are only good for the finite, but may do damage to the infinite. Kennedy's moonshot was made in the context of the larger infinite vision that America's founding fathers laid out. That our progress is not for the benefit of a few, but for the benefit of many. In the sentences before Kennedy proposed his moonshot challenge, he offered the infinite context for the finite objective. We set sail on this new sea because there is new knowledge to be gained and new rights to be won, and they must be won and used for the progress of all people. This was his belief for a good many of his objectives, including landing a man on the moon and returning him home safely. Though moonshots are inspiring for a time, that inspiration comes with an expiration date. Moonshots are bold, inspiring finite goals within the infinite game, not instead of the infinite game. Being the best is not a just cause. We will be the global leader in every market we serve and our products will be sought after for their compelling design, superior quality, and best value. This is a pretty typical-sounding corporate vision or mission statement. This one belongs to Garmin, the maker of GPS devices for everyone from runners to pilots. Though there are dozens of variations, the basic formula is the same. We're the best, and everyone wants our products because our products are the best, and they're great value. Gotta squeeze that in. Again, vision or mission statements act like compasses. They guide our direction. However, because there are no standards on how to write such statements, ones like the preceding one have become too common. Broad and generic, they offer little to no value to a company that wants to adopt an infinite mindset. Being the best, and statements like that, are egocentric statements that place the company as the primary subject, and thus the primary beneficiary, of their vision. They don't help make the company relevant to those who buy from the company. In fact, any mention of the customer or any offer of value usually comes at the end of the statement. By putting the egocentric statement first, it directs leaders to focus their efforts inwards and not on actual people who buy the product. And just because people may buy or like the product does not mean they believe in or even know what the cause is. Leaders with a finite mindset often confuse having a successful product with having a strong company, which is a little like the owners of the Los Angeles Lakers thinking their team is relevant because LeBron James has relevance. Having a great player, a popular product, or a killer app does not mean we are equipped for the infinite gain. Vision statements that place the product at the center of the vision are only useful so long as nothing better ever comes along, there is never any deviation in market conditions, and no new technology is ever invented. If, however, any of these things does happen, the company will be left with a vision statement that often leaves them clinging to an old business model and blind to the opportunities they could have captured. This seems to be what happened to Garmin. In 2007, Garmin may have been the best, the global leader in dash-mounted GPS units for cars and boats. However, as smartphones became more reliable and more capable, we had less need for a separate GPS unit anymore, and the company suffered as a result. It is now worth less than a third of what it was worth in 2007. It's too easy for Garmin to simply blame the rise and ubiquity of smartphones to explain their losses, which they did. What they failed to recognize is that they had a vision statement that directed them to focus on their product, and in so doing, they missed the opportunity that smartphones offered them. Had they been obsessing about how to provide the value to customers first, they may have seized the chance to develop the go-to navigation app for mobile phones when the opportunity still existed. Their brand was certainly strong enough to do so. Instead, they continued to focus on the business model they had, selling dash-mounted hardware. Now the default navigation apps on our phones are Waze, or Google Maps, or Apple Maps. But they didn't have to be. A just cause should direct the business model, not the other way around. When a statement of vision or mission is grounded in the product, it can have adverse effects on the corporate culture also. For companies that place their product above all else, which is fairly common among technology or engineering companies, it leaves people who are not engineers or product designers feeling like, and sometimes actually treated like, second-class citizens in their own companies. An organization is better served if everyone, including those in accounting, support, or customer service roles, for example, is made to feel like they are not just there to serve the needs of the engineers or product development teams. They too want to feel like valuable members of the team, working together to advance something bigger than the product or themselves. Being the best simply cannot be a just cause. Because even if we are the best, based on the metrics and timeframes of our own choosing, the position is only temporary. The game doesn't end once we get there. It keeps going. And because the game keeps going, we often find ourselves playing defense to maintain our cherished ranking. Though saying we are the best may be great fodder for a rah-rah speech to rally a team, it makes for a weak foundation upon which to build an entire company. Infinite-minded leaders understand that best is not a permanent state. Instead, they strive to be better. Better suggests a journey of constant improvement and makes us feel like we are being invited to contribute our talents and energies to make progress in that journey. Better in the infinite game is better than best. Growth is not a just cause. Imagine you walk out of your house one morning and see your neighbor packing up his car. Where are you going? You ask. Vacation, he replies. Nice. Where are you going? You follow up curious. I told you. Vacation, he replies again. I got that, you say. But where are you going? Exasperated, your neighbor replies again. I told you. Vacation. Realizing that your line of questioning will not reveal the answer you're looking for, you try a new strategy. Okay, you say. How do you plan to get to your vacation? And immediately your neighbor offers their plan. I'm going to drive down the I-90, and my goal is to drive 300 miles per day. If the question asked is what is your company's cause, why does your company exist, and the answer offered is growth, that's a lot like your neighbor responding vacation to the question where are you going. The leaders of these growth-oriented companies can rattle off their strategies and targets for growth, but that's like explaining which highway and how many miles you plan to travel when heading on vacation. It doesn't paint a picture of why you set off in the first place or where you hope to go. It doesn't offer a larger context or purpose for that growth. Money is the fuel to advance a cause. It is not a cause itself. The reason to grow is so that we can have more fuel to advance the cause. Just as we don't buy a car simply so we can buy more gas, so too must companies offer more value than their ability to make money. A company, like a car, is more valuable to all constituents when it takes us somewhere to which we would otherwise be unable to go. That place we envision going to is the just cause. It's worth noting that so many of the goals that companies put forward tend to be arbitrary or overly ambitious. Especially in the startup world, the drive for billion-dollar valuations is not an indicator of a healthy company that is built to last. It is a standard that has evolved thanks to the venture capital industry, because valuations are how they make their money. A strong culture and the ability to fund its own existence, also known as profitability, is how a company actually stays in the game for the long term. In addition, the constant drive for hypergrowth creates a problem within mature markets, markets in which the product, technology, or business is no longer new or special, but accepted and ubiquitous. For companies in those markets, companies like Sears or GE, their options are unattractive if they maintain a growth-at-all-costs mentality. Many start to play defense, give their money away to shareholders to court their favor, or overuse stock buybacks to keep their stock price artificially inflated. Growth through acquisition or merger often becomes the only way mature, finite-minded companies can continue to demonstrate high rates of growth. This may win a short-term boost in the stock market. However, as Harvard Business Review and many others have reported, 70 to 90% of acquisitions are abysmal failures. To offer growth as a cause, growth for its own sake, is like eating just to get fat. It pushes executives to consider strategies that demonstrate growth with little to no consideration of any sense of purpose for that growth. Just like it would affect a human being, it should come as no surprise that the organizations that eat to get fat will eventually suffer from health problems. Growth as a cause often results in an unhealthy culture, one in which short-termism and selfishness reign supreme, while trust and cooperation suffer. Growth is a result, not a cause. It's an output, not a reason for being. When we have a just cause, we are willing to sacrifice our interests to advance it. When we think money or growth is the cause, we are more likely to sacrifice others or the cause itself to protect our interests. Besides, nothing can grow forever. All balloons and bubbles eventually burst, even financial ones. Corporate social responsibility is not a just cause. The company advertised all the good they did in the community. They shared the stories of some of the people who benefited from the scholarships they funded, for example. They wanted their customers and their employees to know they cared about people, which would have been great if the 60,000 people who actually worked for the company didn't have to work in such a top-heavy, dog-eat-dog, toxic culture. A corporate social responsibility program is not a just cause. And a company is not cause-driven because they sponsor walkathons, donate to charity, or give employees paid time off to volunteer. Nor are they cause-driven because they give away their products to people who can't afford them. CSR programs are, for the most part, business speak for giving to charity. And though having a CSR program is indeed great and commendable, unless you're a charity, it's only a piece of what a company does. The CSR program must be part of the broader strategy to advance the just cause, a strategy that includes everything the company does. The way a company makes its money and the way it gives it away must both contribute to advancing the just cause. Cause-related work is not something an organization does on the side. It is core to their very being. Service is not an ornament. It is a touchstone. And no amount of corporate social responsibility is enough to offset or balance the excessive, finite focus that may consume the rest of the corporate culture. Even well-intended, finite-minded leaders often have the perspective of make money to do good. An infinite perspective on service, however, looks somewhat different. Do good, making money. The order of the information matters. I will do good in how I treat people and serve my community throughout my life and still build a financially strong organization. It is not so much an equation as it is a lifestyle. These individuals and companies work to be the stewards of the lives of those who work for them and for the communities in which they operate. The giving that happens during and at the end of their lives looks more like a continuation of what they've been doing for decades rather than an attempt at balancing the past. The difference is determined by the leader's mindset. Chapter 4. Keeper of the Cause. Sam Walton founded Walmart in 1962 with a simple idea: to serve the average working American by offering the lowest prices anytime, anywhere. At the end of his life, Walton described his vision this way: if we work together, we'll lower the cost of living for everyone. We'll give the world an opportunity to see what it's like to save and have a better life. With Walton at the helm, the decisions that went into building Walmart, from where to locate the stores to how big they would be, were all made with this cause at the forefront. And as a result, people loved Walmart, both those who worked there and those who shopped in their stores. People wanted Walmart stores in their communities. The business grew, and Walton, who had grown up during the Depression, became one of the richest men in America. And then, somewhere along the way, the just cause went fuzzy. By the time Mike Duke took over as CEO in 2009, it was clear that it was no longer the driving force behind the company. Indeed, Walton's original vision was now little more than marketing slogans and hollow words written on the office walls. The company had become obsessed with profit, growth, and dominance at the expense of the very cause that drove their success in the first place. Mike Duke earned a reputation at Walmart for being an expert in efficiency. When it was announced that Duke would be the next CEO, his predecessor, H. Lee Scott Jr., stammered, "I kind of thought, and I think the board thought, that the company could be better managed." He went on to explain, "Mike is not only a good leader, but a really good manager. I don't think in business you can forget the fact that you don't just have to lead, you have to manage." If the board was hoping to correct management issues or enhance performance, then giving a man like Mike Duke the reins might have been a perfect choice, for the short term. But if the board was concerned that Sam Walton's just cause had been diluted, then a man like Mike Duke was about the worst person to get the company back on track. Duke's own words when he accepted the position revealed the kind of mindset with which he was going to lead. "Walmart is very well positioned in today's economy, growing market share and returns, and is more relevant to its customers than ever," he said in the press release announcing his new role. "Our strategy is sound, and our management team is extremely capable. I am confident we will continue to deliver value to our shareholders, increase opportunity for our over 2 million associates, and help our 180 million customers around the world save money and live better." Notice the order of the information. Duke's first thought was growing market share and returns. Though he talks about being relevant to customers, He doesn't actually mention delivering value to them until the end of his statement. It's a strange quirk of human nature. The order in which a person presents information, more often than not, reveals their actual priorities and the focus of their strategies. Where Sam Walton started with the people's interests, Mike Duke started with Wall Street's. Under Duke's leadership, Walmart's stock price did increase, for a while. However, focusing on numbers before people comes at a cost. The once-beloved brand also found itself embroiled in multiple scandals over the treatment of their people and their customers. In 2011, Walmart was the target of one of the largest employment discrimination class action suits ever filed, brought by female employees who claimed they were victims of systematic underpayment and underpromotion. In 2012, there were walkouts and protests by workers who demanded to be treated with dignity and respect and paid a livable wage. Where before communities would rally to bring a Walmart into their neighborhoods, now they were rallying to keep them out. The company's plans for expansion in Denver and New York, for example, were halted by mass protests. There was also a congressional investigation into allegations that Walmart bribed foreign officials to court favor abroad. Needless to say, morale at the company plummeted, and much of the love people had for the stores was replaced with contempt. What happened at Walmart happens all too often in public companies, even the cause-driven ones. Under pressure from Wall Street, we too often put finite-minded executives in the highest-ranking leadership position when what we actually need is a visionary, infinite-minded leader. Steve Ballmer, as we've already discussed, was one such example. John Sculley, who replaced Steve Jobs at Apple in 1983, was another. Instead of trying to continue advancing the cause, Sculley was more focused on competing head-to-head against IBM. The damage he did to the culture seriously hurt Apple's ability to innovate. In 2000, after being passed over for the CEO job at GE, Robert Nardelli took over at Home Depot. His nickname at GE was Little Jack, because of how much he emulated and hoped to succeed Jack Welch as CEO. His relentless drive for cost-cutting all but destroyed a culture of innovation at Home Depot. In 2004, the COO, Kevin Rollins, replaced Michael Dell to become CEO of Dell. Focused on growth, he presided over the largest layoffs in the company history, a rise in customer complaints, and an SEC investigation over accounting issues. These men were all skilled executives. However, their finite mindsets left them ill-qualified for the job they had been given. In fact, Sculley at Apple and Rollins at Dell did such damage to their respective organizations that their more infinite-minded predecessors, Steve Jobs and Michael Dell, were brought back to try to repair the messes they made. The problem isn't how skilled an executive is when they take over as CEO. The problem is whether they have the right mindset for the job they are given. We need a new title. The responsibility of every C-level executive is baked into their title: Chief Financial Officer, Chief Marketing Officer, Chief Technology Officer, Chief Operating Officer. What they are required to do, what they are required to oversee, is right there in their title. One of the things that the title does is help ensure that we put the right person in the right job. Few would ever consider someone who hates numbers and has never been able to understand a balance sheet for a CFO position. And if you find technology confusing and still have that old VCR connected to your TV at home, odds are you're not on any shortlist to be a CTO anytime soon. So it begs the question, what exactly is a chief executive officer? The lack of a clear standard for the role and responsibilities of the CEO in our organizations is one of the reasons we find too many leaders of companies playing the finite game when they should at least be thinking about the infinite game. In too many cases, it's that their title hasn't properly set them up for the job they have. The word executive doesn't tell us what a CEO is responsible for. Words matter. They give direction and meaning to things. Pick the wrong words, intentions change, and things won't necessarily go as hoped or as expected. Martin Luther King Jr. gave the I Have a Dream speech, for example. He didn't give the I Have a Plan speech. There is no doubt he needed a plan. We know he had meetings to discuss the plan. But as the CEO of the civil rights movement, Dr. King was not responsible for making the plan. He was responsible for the dream and making sure that those responsible for the plans were working to advance the dream. General Lori Robinson, who, when she retired from the Air Force in 2018, was the highest-ranking female officer in the history of the United States military, explains that the responsibility of the most senior person in an organization is to look beyond the organization. I will go up and out. I need you to go down and in, is how she framed her responsibility every time she took a new command. If the top person needs to focus on up and out, then we need their title to help frame their primary responsibility. Leaders in the infinite game will be better equipped to fulfill their responsibilities if they understand that they are stepping into the role of a chief vision officer, or CVO. That is the primary job of the person who sits at the pointy end of the spear. They are the holder, communicator, and protector of the vision. Their job is to ensure that all clearly understand the just cause and that all other C-level executives direct their efforts to advancing the cause inside the organization. It's not that an infinite-minded leader is entirely unconcerned with the organization's finite interests. Rather, as the keeper of the cause, they take accountability for deciding when short-term finite costs are worth it to advance the infinite vision. They think beyond the bottom line. As the ultimate infinite player, the CVO must go up and out. Next in line for the top job. In too many of our companies today, we organize around a single line of hierarchy. The CEO is the number one job, and CFO or COO are usually seen as number two. And in the vast majority of businesses, most CFOs or COOs see themselves in line for the top job. Michael Dinkins, who worked at GE for 17 years under Jack Welch, explained, "I think one of the reasons why a lot of CFOs are being elevated to the CEO role is because the CFO is one of the few positions that sees the total company," he said. "Everything that's going on within the company. They understand processes within the company and the time frame of these processes to happen. They see how HR is recruiting. They see how a manufacturing plant is going to introduce new equipment. They understand the quality control systems that are over the business. They see the whole company, and there's an advantage to that." Mr. Dinkins' statement makes sense if we are looking for a tactical, finite-minded leadership, but not if what we need is a CVO. A CVO is not an operations or a finance job. Whereas CVOs focus on up and out, CFOs and COOs focus on down and in. One requires eyes on the infinite horizon, the other requires eyes on the business plan. One envisions the very distant abstract future, the other sees the steps to take in the tangible near term. This is one of the reasons the best organizations are often run in tandem. The combination of the keeper of the vision, the CVO, and the operator, the CFO or COO. It is a partnership of complementary skill sets. We are more likely to get these partnerships if we adjust the formal hierarchies in our companies to promote the right mindset to fit the purpose of the job. This means we need to stop seeing the CEO as number one and the CFO or COO as number two and start thinking of them as vital partners in a common cause. One does not know how to do the other's job better than they do, which is why they need each other. Remember, Steve Ballmer, John Sculley, and Kevin Rollins all thrived when they were working alongside their more infinite-minded partners. Though the CVO is more often in the spotlight, and though the CVO is often given more of the praise, publicly at least, both players must have the strength of ego to know it is a trusted partnership. The CVO knows they cannot advance the vision alone and needs someone like Michael Dinkins described by their side. The COO or CFO knows that their skills can work to vastly greater scale and meaning if they are applied to help advance an infinite just cause, something bigger than themselves or the company. Such a model has precedence. In the military, there are officers and enlisted ranks who work alongside each other. To rise in the enlisted ranks, is a different trajectory than a rise in the officer ranks. They are entirely different career paths. There is no conflict of interest when they work together, because the most senior enlisted leader on a base cannot aspire to take the job of the most senior officer, and vice versa. When these partnerships work, the CVO and the COO or CFO spend more time thanking and celebrating each other than competing for attention. An uncomfortable truth for many CFOs or COOs is that they have already reached the top level of their skill set. They are already the most senior, most skilled financial or operations people in the organization, which is a great thing. Without them, the CVO would not be able to advance the vision. But that doesn't mean they are equipped to be at the forefront, leading that vision. For many, once they get the top job, they are more likely to continue doing what they know and do well, thinking about how big they want their companies to be and what kinds of margins, EBITDA, EPS, or market share they aim to achieve, finite pursuits, than they are to embrace the new responsibility of imagining what a future could look like and how the company might advance a just cause, an infinite pursuit. It's like a salesperson who is promoted to sales manager. They might have excelled at making sales, but they are no longer responsible for selling. They are now responsible for taking care of the people who do the selling. If they fail to shift gears, adjust their mindset, and learn a new set of skills for their new responsibility, problems will ensue. Any CFO, COO, or other executive can absolutely succeed as CVO if they also learn to adapt to their new role and new responsibilities and embrace an infinite mindset. If they fail to do so, they will likely default to the skills that got them their previous job, which increases the probability that they will steer the company down a very finite path. Whether or not he was qualified to be CVO of Walmart, Duke failed to adjust for the role he was given. He failed to champion Sam Walton's vision into the next century. In contrast, Duke's successor, Doug McMillon, could prove to be the CVO that Walmart needs. When his new position was announced in 2013, McMillon said in a press release, "The opportunity to lead Walmart is a great privilege. Our company has a rich history of delivering value to customers across the globe, and as their needs grow and change, we will be there to serve them. Our management team is talented and experienced. Our strategy gives me confidence that our future is bright. By keeping our promise to customers, we will drive shareholder value, create opportunity for our associates, and grow our business." McMillon presented his priorities in literally the exact opposite order that Mike Duke had when he stepped up to lead the company 5 years earlier. McMillon put Sam Walton's vision first. It is exciting to see how he is re-equipping Walmart to once again play in the infinite game.